I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Friday, March 27th, 2009. We're going to start out with a work session on House Bill 2658, and then we'll get into the public hearings. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2658. And could I have Margie Hoffman come up and talk to us about the amendment to this bill?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time in hearing this bill today and considering the Dash 1 amendment. When we originally brought this bill before the committee a couple of weeks ago, it read country of origin, and we have changed that language to read point of origin. The need for this bill is so that our dentists can have access to information about where permanent implants and temporary implants that they're putting in their patients' mouths are made, and so that they can keep a record of that. I've done additional research to look at the trend nationally. There are currently two other states, South Carolina and Florida, that have a similar law. And the reason behind that is that there have been cases where the National Laboratory of Science has found traces of lead in some of these implants, and they're not supposed to be there's not supposed to be traces of lead in the implants. So as the National Laboratory of Science is looking into where the problem is occurring and why the problem is occurring, we feel that it's necessary for our dentists to be able to keep track of information as to where the devices are being manufactured and keep that in the patient file. So with that, I hope that you support the bill as amended with the Dash 1 amendments. You can do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Cowan.
I have a comment, Mr. Chair, if I could, please. I was hesitant when this bill came before us before, and I needed to do a little more research on it. Frankly, at this point in time, I don't think it's strong enough. So I will be supportive. I've talked to my personal dentist who feels that a dentist should demand that they use a lab that sends not just this information but certification, and he went so far as to go into the back room and get out a device that was destined for somebody and prove to me that there's this little certification form that he gives to his patients. There are some very, very fine labs that provide that. So I'm not going to be objecting to this bill. I'm going to be supporting the bill, but I'm telling you that right now dentists can and should get this information and should be able to demand it from their laboratories.
So yeah, the bill for next session. We don't know what conditions are.
So do you have a comment on that?
Chair Holby, Representative Cowan, no, I just really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, it sounds like a perfect job for an amendment on the other side of this building. So, you know, it does have another opportunity at that. I'd like to go ahead and move this bill out of my committee, though, at this point, if there's not a tremendous amount of changes in votes that were indicated to me last time.
When you say tremendous...
That doesn't count you. So with that, do I have a motion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move that Dash 1 amendment be amended to House Bill 2658.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendment be adopted to House Bill 2658. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move that we pass House Bill 2658 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2658 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Cindy, will you give us a roll call vote, please, in reverse alphabetical order this time?
I'm watching the clock. I have to beat
our no.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
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 Representative Barton?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye.
Thank you.
House Bill 658, having received the required votes, is declared passed.
I think Gilliam should carry it. He can do that on the floor, too.
I agree.
Representative Gilliam will be the carrier of the bill.
Monstrous.
I have that one.
With that, close the work session on House Bill 2658 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3163.
Okay, here we go.
Committee, House Bill 3163 is about refund anticipation loans, and this was a subject matter that a couple of us might remember from this committee from last session. We looked at these loans last session and were concerned about them, but really couldn't find a lot that the state of Oregon could do in most of these cases. But it continues to be an area of concern, and especially since we passed the payday lending legislation last year with a 36% cap. These types of loans based on future income tax returns oftentimes exceed that. And so I introduced this bill and wanted to take another look at this to see if there was some way that we could, I guess, try to protect consumers' money in this arena. So that's the purpose for this bill before us today. And with that, I'd like to call up Angela Martin and Graham Trainer. And and Matt Wallace, please. And I am going to try to keep our comments shorter than normal today. I have several committee members that need to do some extensive traveling tonight, and I'd like to accommodate them if I can.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Martin. I will move through my testimony as quickly as I can, starting by saying thank you not only for letting me present this information today, but thank you to the chair for your work and support on this bill. Again, for the record, Angela Martin, representing our Oregon. Refund anticipation loans, or RALs, are very short-term, 1 to 2 week loans secured by a taxpayer's expected refund. You go into the tax preparer, and after completing your refund, the facilitator will facilitate a loan against your anticipated refund and connect you with a bank to make that happen, and it's all very seamless. The customer receives cash for that loan in a few days. Many lenders also offer a same-day loan for an extra fee. The bank sets up a dummy account to receive your deposit. The customer gives the creditor the right to have their refund deposited into that account and take money from that account to pay the loan off. The other high-cost refund product is a refund anticipation check, or what you'll hear me refer to as a RAC. This is not a loan. It's a payment device. Similar to the RAL, the customer gives permission to the tax preparer to set up a dummy account with a bank. The proceeds of their check, when they arrive from the IRS, are put into that account, and the tax preparer or the bank actually will issue a payment device, a written check, an EBT card, or an electronic transfer to the customer's bank account. A RAC carries, I'll talk about the fees in a second. It's important to point out that a RAC does not speed up delivery of a person's refund. RALs can carry triple-digit APRs, which are fairly steep cost for such a short-term loan. The fee for a typical $3,000 loan starts at $62, which is the low end represented by H&R Block. They have recently dropped their fees for a portion of their lenders. The high end reaches above $100, and this is simply the fee on the loan itself. I'm going to talk a little bit about the add-on fees in just a second. Did mention the refund or the fee reduction that one of the industry partners, H&R Block, has put forth to a portion of their customers. It's important to note that this fee reduction didn't reduce the overall cost to consumers by very much. In 2007, consumers paid an estimated $833 million in RAL fees. Again, only a slight decline from the previous year. In 2007, more than 63,000 Oregonians paid a fee to receive their tax refund. An additional 90,000 taxpayers had a $30 sliced off for that refund anticipation check. Consumers who don't go to one of the major chains often are subject to a host of additional fees. Application fee, administrative fee, e-filing, processing, you just talked to me type of fee. This is where a lot of the damage can be done. Federal authorities, including the Government Accountability Office, conducted surveys recently and revealed that these add-on fees can put an extra $370 to $460 on top of the interest rate that a taxpayer would pay for this very short-term loan. One of the arguments that we hear is that customers willingly pay these fees because they want their money fast. Last year, federal authorities conducted a telephone survey of RAL recipients, asking them a host of questions. One of them was, how long would you be willing to wait to receive your tax refund? They found the answer to that was an average consumer who had received a RAL was willing to wait 9 days to receive their money. Those same federal authorities in that research study that they did found that the average IRS wait time for a direct deposit was 10 days. So consumers are willing to wait and instead, through a variety of practices, end up paying a lot of money for something that they're claiming to not even want that much. All told, Oregon taxpayers lost $23 million to refund anticipation loans, anticipation checks, and tax preparation fees. In the packet that I passed out is a chart put together by Children's Defense Fund outlining the cost to Oregon taxpayers in the last tax years. One of the pieces I really want to bring out in this is the high-cost tax refund products, the impact it has on some of our lowest-wage workers, those individuals who receive the earned income tax credit. According to the IRS data, 85% of taxpayers who applied for a RAL in 2007 had an adjusted gross income of less than $40,000 a year. That same IRS data shows us that in 2007, about 5% of Oregon taxpayers received a rapid refund loan. However, 63% of EITC recipients received a high-cost RAL. In other words, EITC recipients who represent less than 20% of taxpayers received two-thirds of the high-cost tax loans. It's clearly a product that's been targeted to our lowest-income workers. The EITC, as I'm sure you all know, is the largest federal anti-poverty program designed to honor work, help offset payroll taxes for low-income workers, and reduce poverty. The very idea that this is being drained through these products is a hope of a policy concern. So the specific provisions of House Bill 3163. Let me walk through those with you. House Bill 3163 is based on a model act that was written after the Second Court of Appeals held that federal banking law preempted the interest rate cap of state laws in Connecticut, and there was another state that was included. So you heard Chair Holvey mention that we've attempted to get our hands around this before, so have other states. And it has been ruled that straight-up caps are preempted by federal law. This bill here was drafted in response to that and addresses areas where states can still regulate. I'll let you review current regulation. One of the first things that 3163 would do is shift regulation of tax loan facilitators to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. House Bill 3163 does not propose that DCBS regulate tax preparers. Our Oregon Tax Preparers Board can continue to do that. This simply says that if an entity wants to make a loan against someone's tax refund, they need to be registered with the agency that currently provides oversight of our lending institutions, and that's the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Disclosures. This is the area where we can make significant improvements in how we transmit information to the consumer. Again, we rely on studies that have been done on how consumers receive this information. And one of the things that really came forth from the studies is that oral disclosures are a key component for consumers to have meaningful knowledge and understanding of the nature, the cost, and the terms of the tax refund product they're being sold. When someone walks into that office, the consumer is dependent upon the advice of the paid tax preparer, and they rely on that advice to make decisions. Studies show that as a consumer sitting down, going through the process, sharing a lot of personal financial information, and going through a fairly lengthy process, when it gets to the end, working through a stack of written disclosures is not something the tax preparer or the customer are likely inclined to do. Again, this phenomenon was observed in secret shopper tests in various states. It is also the case that written disclosures are not accessible to all consumers. We know that about 14% of consumers are functionally illiterate. These customers depend on oral disclosures as the only way to ensure that they understand the terms and the prices of their loan products. One other improvement on the disclosures I want to call out is that it would make disclosures available in the language that the facilitator uses to solicit and negotiate the loan. This provision is only triggered if the facilitator chooses to advertise, solicit, or conduct the transaction in a language other than English. If the tax preparer only communicates with the customer in English, regardless of the language the customer uses, the disclosures would only need to be presented in English. Finally, to capping fees. I mentioned that states are preempted from capping fees on federally regulated institutions. Federal preemption upheld through a recent court ruling does prevent states from limiting RAL fees charged by banks. However, states still have the authority to curb fees charged by non-bank lenders and prohibit the excessive add-on fees charged by some facilitators. I want to point out that while reviewing House Bill 3163 in preparation for this hearing, it came to my attention that two small amendments would be necessary to achieve this goal. One of them would need to insert in Section 8, Subsection 1, language indicating that the cap does not apply to bank institutions. It only applies to non-bank institutions. This is a language that was included in model legislation. It slipped my attention that it was not in this bill. And then perhaps the most important thing that we could add to this bill, state policymakers could do to make taxpayers hold on to more of their refund, is to insert language prohibiting the exorbitant add-on fees, those processing, e-filing, I saw you today sorts of fees. Again, states do have the ability to cap these fees, and this is where we see real excess added to the cost of these loans. I'll wrap up by quickly discussing the enforcement. House Bill 3163, DCBS would have the authority to revoke a facilitator's registration for continued violations of the law. In addition, violations of the consumer protection and disclosure portions would be enforceable through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. This is an important consumer protection that would allow the Department of Justice to follow course with actions that other states have taken to protect consumers. Altogether, these protections will help put much-needed money back into the pockets of our Oregon taxpayers and help families just as they are struggling to make ends meet. Before getting up here, or sitting down to provide you testimony, I passed out or handed in testimony from a few folks that weren't able to join us today. You should have that in front of you, both from SEIU, Innovative Housing, and I know that AARP also submitted testimony in support of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Graham Treanor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. I just want to thank the committee for the opportunity to share comments on 3163 and to testify in support of the bill. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents over 225,000 working Oregonians, is a leading voice on healthcare reform, good jobs, retirement security, and in this instance, speaking about the subject matter, rebuilding the broken middle class that we're dealing with. As Angela also mentioned, we appreciate the work that this committee did in the 2007 legislature for in the attempt to fight for working Oregonians through the addressing predatory lending practices and specifically dealing with the payday lending challenges that the state has faced. We feel that HB 3163 is an excellent step, next step in protecting the most vulnerable of our population, and again, working to rebuild that broken middle class. As Angela mentioned, and as you'll see in many of your handouts, the statistics speak for themselves. The rates that these refund anticipation loans see, the number of people being sold these refund anticipation loans who also are recipients of the earned income tax credit. We feel that addressing the excessive add-on fees, regulating advertising, and requiring registration, accountability, and oversight are critical steps to deal with the abuse in this process. I'll mention unemployment for once. The unemployment rate in the state, we all know, is getting close to 11%, and many of our affiliates are actually seeing unemployment rates at 2 and 3 times that of the state unemployment rate. And we, the Oregon AFL-CIO, feel strongly that we do need to protect hard-pressed Oregonians from being taken advantage of with targeted predatory lending practices. And we encourage strongly the committee to pass House Bill 3163, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Great. For the record, Matt Wallace with Osprey. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to weigh in and support House Bill 3163 before you today. From our standpoint, the issue boils down to just a couple of main, top-line points in the problem. Much in the way that we saw in the payday lending industry, we have a situation where you have relatively short-term loans with relatively static fees, a lot of tack-on fees, which when you calculate those out as annual percentage rates, as you would for a normal or other type of loan, you look at a triple-digit, really exorbitant rates. And that's a problem whether you're a low-income person, a middle-class person, or really at any income scale. And then secondly, these loans are streamlined as such a part of the process that the disclosure that exists is failing to be effective for consumers who are looking to take one of these loans. So as you heard, how 3163 addresses these key problems by, again, extending the same sort of principles we looked at when the legislature acted on payday loans and capping those interest rates to a reasonable degree, a pretty high degree at 36%, which will really end some of the worst abuses in the marketplace and provide consumers the information they need to make informed, savvy decisions by actually adding that little verbal stop in the process, making sure that consumers are hearing loud and clear, what the loans will entail and the fees that they will entail before they, they sign those papers, which is just a common sense step to make sure consumers know what they're getting into. And then, finally, just making sure that we do have registration and bonding, which are really common sense for lending activity, making sure those are happening the same way they do for other types of lending activity here in the state. So for those reasons, we're definitely in support, and also, of course, support the potential amendment to to put a cap on some of the exorbitant add-on and tack-on fees, which is where you see some of the most sort of abusive features of a lot of these refund anticipation loans. So I'll leave my spoken comments there.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
You're looking past me, Chair, hopefully. Angela, why wouldn't you want to go back and do an amendment and exclude banks, just out of curiosity? Because you said you're looking at changing that and excluding them.
Chair Holvey.
To me, if someone's doing something to hurt the public, it should apply to everybody and not just one particular group.
Chair Holvey, Representative, the reason that would be necessary is due to federal preemption. If the state does not have the authority to cap the fees on federally regulated financial institutions. So the federal government has made a clear decision to come in and preempt state laws in one for one type of entity, bank, you know, financial institutions. They have left to the states the opportunity to regulate the rest of the players in the field. And that's what 3163 speaks to, is the rest of the players that are not regulated under the same, or they're not subject to the same preemption.
Representative Winger, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Angela, what is the disclosure procedure right now when the customer comes in and receives one of these?
Chair Holvey, Representative Winger, the improvements offered by House Bill 3163 add a layer to the current disclosure process. First, they start by adding the oral disclosures. We see that field tests of consumers in how they consume or receive their information, is that the written disclosures, which Oregon currently provides for, don't penetrate in the way that they need to. So in House Bill 3163, we add oral disclosures so that the information is more accessible to all the consumers. 3163 also adds disclosures in the language in which the loan is negotiated in.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So are you testifying that currently when customers come in, there's no oral explanation of the of whatever it is that they're signing? They're simply handed something silently and asked to read it and then sign it? Because, I've never had one of these, but it's never been my experience that I've gone in anywhere and filled out a form in which the person who was having me sign it didn't make some attempt to walk me through what it was that I was signing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, thank you for the question. Like all regulation, we are not proposing to put rules in place for the best practices or those that employ the best practices out in the field. We propose regulation so that outliers that perhaps don't provide the type of oral disclosures that make the transaction understandable to all the consumers, that it is actually a requirement of the law that they make their product fully explained and fully understandable.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You said there were some folks that went in and did secret studies where they came in and pretended to be consumers. I'm just trying to, you clearly have more experience with these products than I do. I'm trying to get a read on whether or not the people who are offering these are explaining to the consumer what they're signing. And I guess your last answer has me wondering exactly how do we, are we going to leave this to administrative rule as to exactly what it is that you have to do orally to meet the standard?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, to answer the first part of your question, yes, people were not explained. The secret shopper studies, which were done in specific states, and the GAO conducted similar types of studies, showed that the terms of loans are not clearly explained and consumers walk away not fully understanding the cost or the terms of the product they're receiving. The intention of this is to make sure that that is there isn't a murky explanation for consumers. The method of delivery is outlined in the bill itself. It explains that these are the items that will be disclosed, these are the aspects of the product that must be explained to the consumer, and they must be explained both written and orally. I don't have the section in my mind, but I can look that up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. I think we're going to go ahead and move on. And next up, I'd like to have Sybil Hebb. And David Tapman. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center here today, in support of House Bill 3163. I think the pieces, I won't repeat explanations of the bill, the pieces I think that the Law Center is the most supportive of, or that's most important to the Law Center underlying the bill, is the principle of some standardization and regulation as well as disclosure and transparency. As you know, the Law Center's mission is to provide legal services, access to justice to low-income people. Many of our clients are working families who have access through acts of Congress passed long ago to the Earned Income Tax Credit. That's a very important form of relief that encourages families to go to work and incentivizes working, and also provides an offset to Social Security taxes and results in substantial, sometimes, refunds. And this is the benefit that we're talking about, basically, that's at risk because of refund anticipation loans. Those refunds are important to our clients in terms of stability. Many families plan on them and use them for, you know, one-time expenditures that they need to save up for. This is an important benefit, and the successes of that program are really diminished by the proliferation of refund anticipation loans. In and of themselves, they're not necessarily a bad product. The concern that we see from our clients is that people don't understand what it is that they're paying for, and they don't understand how much they're paying, and they don't understand that they can get essentially the same thing for free. And so it feels inappropriate if that's the concept that consumers have. And so many, I don't mean to assail the entire industry, many practitioners operate according to the highest practices, but we unfortunately see examples of consumers who are, we believe, taken advantage of. And so to the extent that the bill provides for disclosure of costs and fees and puts a reasonable cap on those fees, we think that's an important protective measure. We also think that making sure that people have written, and I'll talk about the importance of oral disclosures, but making sure that people have disclosures related to the amount of time that they can expect, within which they can expect their refund to take place, and it's important to disclose that this refund will come back to the families in a relatively similar period of time for free, just by simply moving through the procedures that have been set up to take advantage of the Earned Income Tax Credit. And so I think those are the disclosure pieces that are important to us. Two particular sort of aspects of that are that many of our clients have low levels of literacy, and generally speaking, refund anticipation loans are marketed to clients who are less able to make knowledgeable decisions. And so providing disclosures in writing is useful to a certain extent, but making sure that there is a responsibility to communicate those costs during the transactions is also important. The bill also provides a requirement that certain disclosures be translated into the borrowers, essentially, primary language. We think that's an important principle, as we've testified before here in front of this committee. I think even if there are members of an individual's own community preying upon the trust that a borrower may have for them, that's sort of exactly the point, is we want to make sure that people aren't preying on that trust and taking advantage of that trust in an inappropriate way. So I think that I'll close my remarks just by echoing the support for the principles behind the regulation of this industry and appreciate the committee's attention to the issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tapman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm David Tapman, the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I will echo what Ms. Hebb just said. We generally support the notion of oversight of high-cost loans. We've been in front of this committee and its predecessor committees before. One of the concerns I have is that this is an area that is currently regulated, and there's a fair amount of regulation that is in the books. I'm not familiar with this area very much, so I spent a fair amount of time this week trying to familiarize myself with that. And there are a number of disclosures and requirements already in place. Are they sufficient? What I've heard in testimony today, they are not. What concerns me is, as part of the conversation, we don't have the tax preparers board because their representative is out of town. I would echo what the previous witnesses have said. There's a we share some of these concerns. We certainly are worried about the high cost of making short-term loans, and that disclosures serve their function and not just go through a checkbox process. And so we'd like to learn more about that. There are a number of places in the bill itself where there are some concerns we have about how it would apply, and I don't really need to get into the details right now, other than to say there are places where we think the limitations in some part would facilitate maybe something else taking place. For instance, proposing limits on fees that may be charged for facilitating a refund anticipation loan could result in an effort to go around that by increasing tax preparation fees themselves or something. I think it's important that we look at all this in a whole fashion, if you will, a holistic way, and the Tax Preparers Board would be a key component to that. I would be more than willing to work with all the participants in this, all those that are interested from industry, from consumer advocacy groups, from the Tax Preparers Board, and from our agency, as well as members of this committee, to sit down and make sure that we are covering what needs to be covered. And so with that, I've handed out my written testimony. As I say, we have no specific position on where the right place to put this oversight is, whether it should be DCBS or the Board of Tax Practitioners. That's your decision. But I think that's a conversation that should be had by all potential participants.
Thank you, Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The suggestion is being made that the tax preparer may not be steering the client in a direction that is most financially beneficial to them, that they may be able to get the refund on their own without the fee. So I'm wondering, you know, are there any rules of conduct that apply to tax preparers that, you know, and if an attorney gives improper advice or, you know, I mean, there are other professions that have some oversight where they're expected to advocate for their client's best interest and to not,
understand.
You know, and I'm wondering if the CPA tax preparer community has that same kind of oversight, where whether you work for H&R Block or not, or some other company, if you're the tax preparer, your job is. I'm just wondering if there's some edict or ethical statement that requires them to advocate for the client that's in front of them, their best financial interest.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, a couple of points. First, I know that certified public accountants, as well as lawyers, as well as others that are in professions, are required to meet what you're describing, a fiduciary duty. I can't speak to the tax preparers themselves, whether they're held to that standard or not. As I said, I'm not very familiar with that. I've got the statute in front of me. I'm taking a quick gander at that. Frankly, that's a great question that I'd like to have the tax preparer board here to say, that type of conduct would constitute a violation and they would be able to take action. They do have enforcement action over their tax preparers, and so I don't know if their standard is that you must be devoid of any self-dealing, if you will, where you put your interests ahead of your clients. I can't answer that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm just wondering if that isn't the avenue that all of the interested parties here might be after. I mean, ultimately, rather than trying to address this one specific instance, if this requirement does not apply to tax preparers, maybe what we need to do is change the law to fold them in to the same thing that CPAs and attorneys and everybody else. I mean, I think whether it's this mechanism or some future one that's invented 10 years from now, I think what we really want is to have a belief that whoever the tax preparer or CPA is working for as a company, just as an attorney might work for a large firm, they still, their first responsibility should be that client that's in front of them and what's in their best interest. And it seems to me that if we can simply codify that, we don't necessarily have to try to regulate every device or item that comes along in this industry. I'd throw that out there.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tatman, thanks for your testimony. I appreciate your expertise and the willingness you dive into this issue. I look at your, in the written testimony, and I see that it says the vast majority of the refund anticipation loans are made by nationally chartered banks, presenting some challenges for Oregon to regulate in the area because federal law preempts this. It goes on to kind of say that the created risk here is that the bill is going to be ineffective in addressing the problem. I guess I'm concerned, are we really getting at the root of the problem by passing this bill, or is this just going to be another bill that regulates a very small part of the problem, and it's just going to move those folks to the nationally federally chartered banks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Matthews, I think that I'll try and walk this line, because I think there's merit in what has been proposed here, because you hear fees that are rather high for providing these the facilitation of this lending. The length of time that the loan is outstanding from the time of the making of the loan to the time that the entity, whether it's a state or federal government, pays that taxpayer its refund, his or her refund, is relatively short. I can't tell you how much those fees are, and I wish I could, because I think that might answer some of your questions. But what I heard from Ms. Martin, and I don't know enough to speak to the contrary, was fees of $300+ for essentially a fairly limited role in facilitating this. What I understand is they've got the relationship already established with these couple of national banks that do this kind of refund anticipation lending. Therefore, I don't know how they rationalize their fees. And so if the fees are $300 for this and $300 for that, by cutting it down substantially at the facilitation level, you probably are making some headway in keeping money in the pockets of the people that Ms. Hebb and the previous witnesses mentioned.
Thank you. Representative Comey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Matthews asked the questions that I was going to ask, and I have great interest in this bill, but it seemed, or at least in the intent of the bill, I guess from your testimony, Mr. Tatman, I have the impression that this is not getting at what the supporters of the bill had really intended.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two kind of general areas of concern with this bill. The first, I suppose, I'll call substantive, and indeed, I think your testimony highlights the weaknesses as drafted, as well as the questions and comments of Representative Matthews and Tomei. I share those. The second, I kind of think of as procedural, and that is specifically with, I suppose, some details in sections 12 and 13, which is on pages 9 and 10. That's essentially, I suppose, the delegation clause in which, for example, in section 12 on lines 35 and 36, to provide for consumer protection related to refund anticipation loans, that's potentially a very broad delegation of authority, and I'm wondering if that appears atypical to you. Does that seem narrowly tailored to DCBS's needs, or does that strike you as broad?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, usually I see language delegating the authority or enabling us to do things that says in carrying out the enforcement of these sections. And these sections cover a fairly wide area of law, so it's possible that breadth is mirrored in what we would have to address. It is a little unusual in terms of its breadth, and I have seen it narrowed down to some degree, so I understand your concern. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's so overwhelmingly broad, because I still think it's within the confines of the 15 sections that are limited here. I guess you could argue that this would give us some authority to make rules around those making the loans themselves, and we've already heard that nationally the chartered banks we can't touch, so we would not be pursuing that in any case.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Again, it did strike me, usually it would be, you know, they're, I suppose, restricted to the intent and purpose of the bill. I would feel more comfortable with sort of more narrowly tailored language. I gather that DCBS, from your testimony, won't have an issue with that, nor the proponents. Also, I suppose in Section 13, there are a few things that make me a little nervous. Section 4, which is on page 10, struck me as particularly interesting, actually, in that, for example, if a person fails to comply with a subpoena, the Marion County judge shall. It struck me as essentially this bill is removing discretion, for example, potentially on a motion to quash, from the judge, which I can't imagine that is our intent, because that would be nothing less than an awesome display of legislative power and a delegation of it from the judicial branch to an administrative agency. I'm sure that that is not the intent of DCBS or the proponents of that bill. But in any event, there are a few things. For example, I get the sense that in sections 12 and 13, I'd be happy to talk to you or Mr. Savage or anyone, and hopefully we can work those out. Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, Mr. Representative Barton, I would agree that we can't derogate the authority of a judge like that. We would certainly be in front of one asking for enforcement, but that's the judge's decision, not yours or mine.
Well, we can always try. Appreciate,
and we do often in this committee, Mr. Chair.
So, any other questions, Mr. Tatman or Ms. Hebb? Not seeing any right now. It's you know, obvious this bill has some amendments necessary, and really a look at really what can we do in this arena. And it's unfortunate that we didn't have the Tax Accountancy Board representative here today. It was my intent to have them here, because really part of our solution might be through that as opposed to DCBS. Appreciate you opening up this subject, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
As this comes back, and we talk to tax preparers and such about it, if the direction of this bill stays with it moving to DCBS, which is a new area for them, could we be sure to find out if that's going to be new FTEs for them as well?
Yeah, it certainly looks like it might be in the bill, that's for sure. So with that, any other comments about the bill? I have had one more person signed up to speak. Couldn't really read the name, though, so there. Anybody in the audience that wanted to testify? I just couldn't read the name, so this is the next one. So nobody else wishing to testify, or notice there's no opposition to this bill, which kind of surprised me, signed up to speak today. So,
except from the committee members.
So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3163. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3044. Victoria, would you like to read a brief description of the bill? I forgot you last time.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3044 increases the homestead exemption from $30,000 to $75,000 for an individual debtor and $39,600 to $125,000 for joint debtors. It is effective on passage.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think up first I'd like to have Keith Carnes and Sybil Hebb. Or what's that mean? Oh. Maybe I messed that up. You did not want to come up yet, did you, Sybil?
I can come up whenever you like.
Oh.
Whatever you like.
Now, just somebody come up and start speaking. That'd be good. You'd introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Carnes. I'm here as an attorney in private practice. This bill is somewhat similar to a bill that's in House Judiciary relating to exemptions in general, but I'd like to particularly come and voice my hope that we could pass House Bill 3044 with just a few additions. First, I think the bill sets appropriate limits. We see that in Idaho, Washington, and California, there are similar homestead exemptions to those that are contained in 3044. And due to the economic upheaval and the financial crisis that we're in, giving people a greater homestead would help protect them from the difficulties caused by homelessness and other poverty in general. The few changes that I would recommend would be first to eliminate the distinction between a manufactured dwelling on real estate and a site or stick-built home. Right now, for some reason in Oregon law, we have this great distinction between a manufactured home that's built in the factory and assembled on land versus a home that is built by carpenters. And this bill would actually create a vast diversity between those dollar amounts, and I would recommend that we eliminate that distinction altogether. Secondly, we see that every 4 years, parts of the legislature spend a significant amount of time looking at the homestead and exemptions in general. The federal law in the bankruptcy code ties the exemptions to the consumer price index. And as I understand it, there is one for the entire state of Oregon. The one that I could find very easily was from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics for the Portland and Salem region. And basically, they give an annual number that tells the price of living. And so if that number goes up, then the exemption would go up automatically. And if the number goes down, then the exemption would decrease automatically. The third suggestion that I would have is perhaps allowing people who have some unused portion of their homestead to protect one additional asset on a limited basis. We see folks here who have little or no equity in their home, and it really seems somewhat unfair that people who have homestead, who have homes with equity in them, can protect these assets while those who live in apartments really have very limited exemptions to protect their property, including the vehicles that they use to get to work, their rental deposits. And I have some clients who use their boats to create money and income for themselves. And so I would suggest that perhaps we could allow those who don't have a homestead to use 2% of the homestead amount, whatever it ends up being, to protect one asset for a limit of 5 years, meaning that they could use it once every 5 years. So if I had, for instance, a Ford Focus that my creditors were trying to levy upon, I didn't have any homestead exemption, I could use my 2% to protect my Focus to allow me to get to work and back. Or if I had a tax refund coming, I could use my refund to repair my minivan or whatever I need done so that I can continue to get to work and, you know, take my family for their medical care. Allowing this would be a very limited, it's not something that's used in the state law, our state law today, but it is used in federal law. The bankruptcy exemptions allow a pour over of the homestead exemption to other assets, and I'm not asking for anything or encouraging anything as expansive as that, rather just a one-time attachment to one asset that once the debtor uses it, it would be gone for 5 years and it couldn't be used again. And so with those suggestions, I think this would be a very fair bill and would put us in line with the states that are around us and allow people who do have homes to more readily keep those and provide for themselves so that they're not on the state rolls and they're not in public housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know I was out of the room for a minute, but can you tell me when these, you probably already said it, when these rates that are currently in law were set or when they were last updated?
They were last updated 4 years ago, I believe.
That's not very low. I thought you were going to say 40. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Carnes, can you,
explain the homestead exemption just a little bit more in detail about when that homestead exemption actually applies and what kind of limitations those monies could be used for?
The homestead exemption is basically, it protects the owner's interest in the real estate in which they own and live in. It doesn't apply to other pieces of property like rental property or bare land or anything like that. It just has to be the home that you live in. And it's a protection from judgment creditors. This does not protect a borrower against consensual liens such as mortgages and home equity loans, things like that, nor does it protect them against statutory liens such as tax liens, construction liens, mechanics liens, things like that. Instead, the times where it's used most often, well, basically are three times. One time would be upon the filing of a bankruptcy. A bankruptcy trustee becomes a hypothetical judgment lien creditor. So anything that a judgment lien creditor could extract from the debtor, a bankruptcy trustee can. And so to the extent that a debtor has more equity than is allowed under the Oregon statute, the trustee could force the sale of the home, pay to the debtor their homestead, and then use the rest of the money to make a one-time payment on their creditors in satisfaction of the debts. And that's in a Chapter 7. In a Chapter 13, the debtor actually pays in what's in above it, or they surrender their home. It's, the choice is one or the other. The second time we see this is upon the sale of a home. If when somebody gets sued and a judgment's entered, the judgment acts as a matter of law. It acts as a lien against the property. And so anyone who has judgments entered against him or her upon sale of the home has the right to go into court and have the judge declare that that first amount that's the homestead exemption gets paid to them after their mortgages are paid. So that way they have some money to go out and acquire a new home. The third time where it's less frequently seen but sometimes happens is a judgment creditor can actually force the sale of a home based on these judgment liens. They can have the sheriff go out and sell the home to satisfy these loans, and when the sheriff does that, the first amount or the homestead would go to the borrower or to the debtor, and the rest of the money would go toward the creditors. And so those are the times where we see it. The homestead does expire after a year, and so in the bankruptcy context, what we see is if the bankruptcy trustee sells the home, that he or she would keep the money in their trust account, and the courts have given judges or trustees permission to do this, until the borrower goes out and acquires a new piece of property, and then they will release the money to go into that home. The problem that we're seeing now is that for $40,000 on a down payment on a home, it doesn't, you know, you're obviously not going to buy a piece of property free and clear. And for somebody who's just been in bankruptcy, the prospects of getting financing for the remaining part of that land are pretty bleak in the current economy, and we don't know what's going to happen in the near future. And so by increasing the homestead, those people who are in bankruptcy can either keep their existing home, or if the trustee sells the home, give them enough to go out and buy, you know, a modest home, or do a small amount of financing rather than try and live off of $40,000 for, you know, for their property needs. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it almost did. Just one more clarification. So, I understand that you use that homestead exemption to then get into another home, and the money's released to do that. Can that homestead exemption money, once the debtor gets access to it, can it be used for anything else?
In bankruptcy, the judges have told us repeatedly, no, it cannot. It's if it's done through the bankruptcy process, and bankruptcy relies on state law, even though it's a federal process, no, the judges have said repeatedly, it can only be used to put into a new home. It's the homestead exemption, and it stays the homestead. Whereas the process I described where the sheriff sells the home and gives the first $40,000 to the couple, then that money could be used for whatever the debtor chooses, sure.
Okay, that helps me a little bit.
Um,
Any other questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And please correct me if I don't understand the homestead exemption very well. However, I think that there are a couple conflicting things. On one hand, I don't think any of us want, in these hard economic times, for somebody to go significantly into debt and a judgment creditor to then essentially force them to sell their home, liquidate their home to extract value. I don't think any of us are sympathetic to that, and thus that trend, I think, leads us to support this bill. On the other hand, I don't want essentially to create or increase a shield for liability from tortfeasors. And in yesterday's Oregonian, some of you might have read actually about a recent individual who defrauded investors, essentially a British Columbia pension fund, of $39 million. Because Florida does not have a homestead, essentially the homestead is judgment-proof in the state of Florida, that individual appears to, before having been, the judgment was rendered, appears to have intentionally purchased a $3.9 million mansion in Florida, and now has declared bankruptcy, and that home can't be touched. So on one hand, this also is a shield for tortfeasors, and I'm not quite sure how to reconcile these conflicting trends. I understand this correctly.
Representative Holvey, Representative Barton, I think there's a couple points to be made. As you are likely aware, there's still the doctrine of constructive trusts, that if you use the money by ill-gotten gain to purchase a piece of property, then the judge can actually undo that through other means. There's still fraudulent conveyance statutes and all those other, there's a million other tools, I exaggerate, there's a lot of other tools that can be used to go get that property back in the hands of the people who've been defrauded. Generally speaking, and the second issue as well is one in, especially in the bankruptcy world, debts incurred by fraud or false pretenses or defalcation or embezzlement are non-dischargeable. And so while the creditors may not be able to force sale of the home through the regular judgment process, those debts aren't discharged and they can continue to levy on all these other assets. And so the law has other ways of dealing with this, and I believe that, you know, criminal law may deal with it differently than civil law. However, generally speaking, it is a shield, it is a protection for people, and perhaps there are some who are getting away with bad conduct to do that. I think that that's a very small exception, and the law has a lot of tools to deal with that other than just telling the creditors, we're sorry, but you can't sell their home.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. However, not all, it's not just crimes of fraud that I think concern me in this case. It's when, so an example, instead of, for example, Craig Berkman, I'll use a different example where this might apply, albeit perhaps a polarizing one, and that is O.J. Simpson. Of course, in a civil trial, there was a very, very large verdict rendered against him. Theoretically, a homestead exception essentially would protect him in that context. Now, in no way did the funds to purchase the underlying home, that's not, constructive trust can't get at that. Essentially, what this is this is a shield for potential tortfeasors, and that concerns me. On the other hand, I recognize the good it does, and I'm not sure how I'm going to reconcile this.
Representative Holvey, Representative Barton, the one last point I would make is that we would just be moving into line with Idaho and Washington and, to some degree, California. California has different homesteads depending on your status. But what we see the Mr. Madoffs and the Mr. Simpsons and the Ken Lays of the world going to Texas and Florida, because that's where you have million-dollar protections. You know, if this person were to have a $100,000 home, even in the modest, you know, in the most depressed area of Roseburg, he's not going to be living the high life. I mean, if they had a nice home in Portland that they were trying to protect, they need a whole lot more than $100,000 or $125,000 to protect that. And I'd say, yes, there is some risk of that, but those who are trying to do this on a large scale are doing it in other states, and they're not protecting a whole lot in Portland or in, you know, the Wilsonville or the nicer areas of the state.
Thank you. Tim Callan.
I wasn't quite as confused as I am now, Mr. Chair, until those two started talking.
Sorry,
and now
sorry
I
about that,
what we're talking about.
Sorry about that.
So, with all due respect for these other possibilities, could we get this down to really simple for where I am right now as to what exactly a homestead exemption means in whatever amount, whether it's raised or not. I mean, I've heard that one declares bankruptcy, but you can't take my home. But if that's not the case, the way I heard what was explained, I had a, $200,000 value home and declared bankruptcy, had a $100,000 mortgage on that home. Then are you saying that the home would be sold and I assume the mortgage paid, but I'd get $30,000 or $40,000 and then the rest would go towards debt? Is that what a homestead exemption means? Or?
Well, that's Representative Holvey, Representative Cowan, that's exactly what would happen if,
okay,
in that situation, yes. As we're saying, what is it that a judgment creditor could achieve out of the sale of this home? And in a Chapter 7 or in a Chapter 13, whatever that judgment creditor could get in a regular state court proceeding is what the bankruptcy trustee would be able to do. The trustee also has the power to force sale of the home and, you know, do other things. So in my situation, you know, if I had a $200,000 home, my wife filed bankruptcy and I didn't want to, the trustee could actually force the sale of my home without my permission. He would give me half the equity, he would give her homestead exemption, pay off the loans, and give the rest of the money to the creditors. And so, and bankruptcy is particularly distressing because the trustee has all these extra rights to force sale against an unwilling partner. And so, I hope that didn't confuse him more, but the statement...
Yeah, I did. I'd like to get back to just...
Not my fault this
leave it to the party.
The statement that you said is absolutely correct. Homestead is whatever gets paid after the mortgages, the next in the cost of sale, the next in line goes to the debtor as their homestead exemption. Whatever's left after that gets paid to the creditors as a payment on the debts.
Okay, thank you. I'm really just trying to understand what a homestead exemption is. And if I'm the only one who doesn't know what it is, I apologize for
that. I asked the same question yesterday, so don't feel bad.
Thank you, Paul.
Representative Krieger.
That reminds me of why the founding fathers were going to outlaw attorneys from living within the city limits originally. That is a historical fact. I believe...
Of this city?
No, the United States.
No. Oh. That's intriguing.
Yeah, one of the founding fathers understood the issue. I believe this bill, as I had in my judiciary committee in 2005, and we raised it to these numbers. These were kind of negotiated numbers. I can't remember where they were, but to see them back this soon, and these type of increases, I think are totally unreasonable. Somebody, might be you and I, have an investment in that institution that made these loans, and it may be your stock, it may be your whatever, and you're going to want to be the person that's going to take the loss. Now, two of the things we considered last time is, I was looking, when I did it, I was looking at seniors. What causes most seniors to go bankrupt? Medical. So we were talking about making an exception a little higher for people over a certain age who are probably no longer working and had that ability. And I don't even mind doing that now to a small degree, but nothing anywhere near these numbers. I mean, these numbers wouldn't have come out this close if I'd have thrown a number out there, because there's consequences to the business community. Now, the same thing, these homesteads that these people got back, let's say, 6, 8, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and the money value of that real estate investment has gone up so high, and then now all of a sudden it's going down. It might be that is a huge percentage of the equity they got in that house or beyond that, and they're going to get a lot more benefit from declaring bankruptcy. So I think you got to be real careful here of how we go and how far.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments. Those are good comments, and I've heard similar comments about this. And you know, when we looked at drafting up this bill, I looked at what other states were, and that's where I came up with these numbers.
I really like to have a conversation, Mr. Chair, about seniors, someone that becomes totally disabled, maybe regardless of age, that type of thing, have a different set there. But people who are going to be working and have the ability to recover this like anything else in their life, you know, if they have to change job, they lose their job like so many people have today, they're going to have 15, 20, 30 years or more to recover.
Mr. Carnes, I mean, he made a comment about the mortgage folks, but the mortgage companies wouldn't lose in a homestead exemption. They get paid off. Is that correct?
Yes. In any situation that we're talking about here, the mortgage gets paid in full. The people who typically we see are three typical areas. So there's just general unsecured loans, credit cards, lines of credit, things like that. The second is, you know, repossessed vehicles, and there's a deficiency left. And the third is medical bills. And, you know, most of these credit card companies are, you know, charging interest to hedge against these losses and charging, as the federal government sees it, exorbitant fees and things like that to recover against these type of losses. And so while I agree with the general proposition that people should pay their bills, there has to be some limit that lets them stay on their feet and keep building toward the future. If we wipe out all hope, then they're going to end up on the dole and taking the state's money.
And I'm going to move on here pretty quick, but I have one more question for you, and I hate to ask an attorney to speculate. But in relationship to those credit cards, could you? I mean, it seems like if I was a credit card company, I would probably offer anybody in Oregon a credit card because of the homestead exemption was, you know, much, much less. So if I were to go to the state of Washington, where the homestead exemption is similar to what's in this bill, they may be a little more careful about who they give credit cards to. Do you care to speculate on that?
I won't just speculate in the sense that I don't know something about this, because I've deposed credit card companies about practices and the like. They have to make calculated risks, and the credit card companies, as I understand it, have nationalized lending practices. I don't think that they really say in Oregon we're going to not give credit lines based on, you know, the fact that there's a higher homestead or not. You know, I think that it's more on the default side. You know, I can just tell you briefly that, you know, I had one client who was just short of being able to get a reverse mortgage. He was self-employed and had a heart attack. He was a bricklayer, and he was about to lose his home entirely because of, you know, his creditors were going to auction off his home. And so he was able to, if this bill would have been enacted, he would have been able to hold on to his house just long enough to get a reverse mortgage and pay all these people off instead of, you know, having to go to very difficult measures just to get the money to hold on to his house that he built literally with his own hands. And so we see it more on the default and collection side. I haven't seen any evidence, and I really don't think that Oregon, be honest with you, is big enough to get Citibank's attention or Bank of America's attention to make them change their lending practices based on our homestead bill. I don't think it would be any harder for anyone to get credit here, but, you know, that's based on my experience.
Thank you for the speculation. I appreciate the testimony. I'm going to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, could I have Paul Cosgrove and Jim Marquis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, and as an attorney, I'll speculate if you wish on that issue, but I wanted you to be able to know why the Oregon Financial Services Association has concerns about this bill and opposes it. Some of my members are subsidiaries of big national banks, and they're not affected by this bill because they are, in fact, primarily mortgage lenders, and it's already been brought out. The mortgage comes before the homestead exemption. The rest of my members are small, sometimes one-office, family-owned businesses in places like Baker City and Milwaukee and Springfield, and they are concerned about this bill because they make small, generally unsecured loans. I'm going to talk just about the non-bankruptcy context because I think it's a little more straightforward. Bankruptcy law is sort of like tax law. It confuses people who are specialists, so I'd rather stay in the non-bankruptcy context for my examples. As been pointed out, this is really a balancing process, of how much in terms of assets are shielded from someone's creditors. And someone's creditors run the gamut from people you like to people you don't like. They run the gamut from someone who's hurt in an auto accident and the driver on the other side was underinsured or not insured at all. They are sometimes spouses trying to collect unpaid spousal support. So there are all kinds of creditors, and yes, some of them are small loan companies like my members trying to collect what has not been paid on the loan. So each state has adopted a different set of systems to balance those two policy needs, which is how do you set aside enough for someone to have some sort of a fresh start versus how do you not set aside too much so that legitimate creditors of these various kinds, the ones you like, the ones you don't like, can be paid at least some portion of their debt. It's difficult to deal with this just in the vacuum of the figure, because if you look at our neighboring states, the figure is put into a system that has all sorts of differences, and let me give you an example. If this bill were adopted, a couple in Oregon without children and who are not disabled would have 2.5 times the homestead exemption as a couple in California. They would have less than half if the person was disabled. In other words, some states have made different exemptions for different kinds of people. We've chosen not to do that. We have just one, except for joint debtors, we have a slightly higher amount. Washington is a different system. California is a different system. Idaho is a different system. And in fact, some states also say that the homestead exemption doesn't apply, doesn't protect in favor of certain kinds of creditors. We favor certain kinds of creditors, generally speaking, the state. In collecting its own debts, doesn't have to comply with most states' exemption laws, or at least has to comply in lesser amounts with most states' exemption laws, including Oregon. We protect people who are trying to collect child support against the homestead exemption. The judge is given the discretion to reduce or eliminate a homestead exemption for someone trying to collect child support. Ironically, we don't do that for people trying to get spousal support. So, I mean, there's a whole system that we have set up. Changes like this bill provides, which change one part of it, the dollar amount, and changes it so dramatically, upset that system. And as you've heard from prior testimony, it's a relatively complex area with lots of facets and lots of policy considerations. We would urge that you not do this without contemplation of all of those other impacts and effects, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or provide speculation if the chair would wish me to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, the credit card speculation?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The reason that the credit card example won't be affected as a practical matter in Oregon, we do not permit, it's another change that, especially Oregon, if you have a debt of less than $3,000 or less, you're not permitted to execute against the home, even if it's free and clear. We don't allow small debts to attack a home. Secondly, when you have a homestead exemption, it's given, it's an automatic exemption. It doesn't have to be claimed. It will be paid. And for someone who has a $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 credit card debt they're going to try to collect, and they have a judgment and they execute against the home, they have to write a check for either $30,000 or $40,000 in order to collect $5,000 or $6,000. It doesn't make financial sense. You won't find people who don't have substantial judgments owed a substantial amount going after a homestead in Oregon, generally speaking.
Thanks for the speculation.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Markey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I submitted written testimony, which I will not read, and I know that there are members that want to get out of here today. I really don't have very much to add to what my friend Mr. Cosgrove has said. This is really a balance between shielding someone and yet protecting the folks in bankruptcy and trying to provide a fresh start. The real question is, and the policy consideration is, what should somebody walk away with after they go through bankruptcy and don't pay their creditors? So we think the numbers in this bill are a little high, as I've talk to Mr. Chair about, and I don't know what the right number is. It's indeed a lot of factors involved. The one thing that I would say is that in our discussions with our clients, I don't
believe... Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but I don't seem to have the... There's something from Kate Bessie, but that's
yes, it says Oregon Collectors Association.
Sorry.
Statement.
Thank you.
For
that, thank you.
An attorney.
Okay, I didn't see your name on it, so I wondered if I was missing something. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry. This statement does show some average values of homes. And I believe in Oregon in 07, the average median price of a house was $257,000. So this exemption would be, if I believe that number is probably lower this now than it was then. So in Marion County or the Salem area, I think the median price was around $200,000. So we would be protecting in excess of 50% of the value of those homes. So. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you, Mr. Cosgrove. You talked about how others, the various approaches other states have taken. I really don't know what they are except for Florida, Texas, et cetera. I'm wondering if any other states have carved out essentially an exception to the homestead exception for tortfeasors or anything of that sort.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I know that California, Oregon, Idaho, and Washington have not. Unfortunately, I don't know about the other states. It's obviously a question we can try to find out the answer to.
If not inconvenient.
I will try to find that answer.
Thank you, gentlemen. I just, I know that, the comment has been made that we adjusted this 4 years ago, and it seems like a pretty substantial increase from that we had 4 years ago. And I agree, it does seem like a pretty substantial increase. But I guess the premise is perhaps the rates or the amounts that we had in place 4 years ago and to this day were substantially low, and so it's sort of a relative comparison, I guess, or a subjective comparison, and so I just wanted to offer that out. But I appreciate the comments from Mr. Cosgrove about the different systems. I recognize there's an extremely different system in California, very hard to compare Oregon to California. But on the other hand, Washington, I believe, their system is very similar. So I'd be interested in the differences between the Oregon and Washington system, that does have an amount similar to that in this bill. I don't know if you could...
Mr. Chair, I can give you a couple of them, although I might need to study Washington more to tell you all the differences. In Washington, the amount doesn't differ whether it's a single or a joint person. In Oregon, it does. In Washington, there is no minimum amount where you can't execute against the homestead, regardless of the amount of equity, the $3,000 small debt non-exemption like Oregon has, which means that it is only... You only can use, as a judgment creditor, go after a homestead in Washington if you're, in Oregon, if you're a bigger judgment creditor in Washington, there's no limit. In other words, you can go after a homestead for a $1,000 debt in Washington. Those are the two basic differences that I know of at this moment between our two states. Except let me mention something else, and I think Mr. Kearns mentioned this as well, or someone did. We have different exemption amounts if you're a manufactured home, if you're a mobile home, if you're a stick-built home. Washington does not. We have a different amount of acreage you can have as part of your homestead. It's a bigger 160 acres. Washington, if I recall correctly, is 100. There are all sorts of differences. They were all done differently at different times. There's no really pattern, except that everybody has, I think, a homestead of exemption of some kind.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to move on a little bit quicker here because I know some are leaving, and I was hoping to be out of here by now. But next up, I have Sybil Hebb and Don Miner. and Angela Martin. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, in support of House Bill 3044. I'm grateful that others were available to answer the technical questions that I could not have, but I do have 2 points that I would like to add to the discussion. Number one, I do remember the discussion in 2005 when the minimum, the small increase was accomplished, which resulted in the current law, and I would point out that at that point we were very much at the bottom of the nation in terms of our homestead exemptions. We accomplished a small increase in 2005. We're still at the bottom part of the country. So, as a point of comparison, and I don't know exactly where we fit and would be happy to get that information back to the committee, but there are 6 states that allow for an unlimited homestead exemption. Those are Florida, Iowa, Kansas, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Texas. So, that's the other extreme here. For another sort of middle-of-the-road example, New Mexico and Alaska have 60,000 and 54,000, respectively, and so those are would be substantially greater than what our current exemptions are. So while it would be a big jump, we were very much at the bottom previously, and there's some room for improvement in our current statutes. From the Oregon Law Center's perspective, of course, representing low-income families, we're sort of struggling, especially now, to hang on to their most important asset. Unfortunately, we're seeing more people getting into the problem of bankruptcy, what with crises brought on by military service or healthcare crisis or loss of income, jobs. It's becoming more of an issue for us, and so any protective measures that can be added to the current structure would greatly help our families. I do want to echo the comment that I believe Mr. Carnes discussed related to the exemption or the distinction in our current law between the exemptions that are available for stick-built homes versus manufactured dwellings. And we would really appreciate if there's the opportunity to do that, to erase that distinction, or at the very least substantially reduce it. There's actually not quite such a big distinction right now in the current law with the amounts set as they are, but as an increase moves up, it should apply to both. And we think that there's no substantive policy or practical reason that they should be treated differently. It's a matter of protecting equity, and it's a matter of protecting people's homes. And manufactured dwellings have the same value, certainly to a family because they're a home. But also, maybe there used to be a great distinction in the values of manufactured dwellings versus stick homes. But that's changed in recent times, and I'm aware of one park in Eugene, for example, that recently sold a manufactured dwelling home for over $200,000. And so there are some parks and some homes where these are worth a great deal more money than I think many may have commonly assumed. And so we would appreciate treating those homes the same as stick-built homes. And I think I'll conclude my remarks there. I'd be happy to do some more research about what the provisions are in other states or be a part of further discussions on this bill, and I thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, seems you're the treated special person and the odd man out, so to speak.
Or the thorn amongst the roses. Mr. Chair, Don Meiner, on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, I'd like to echo Sybil's remarks, slightly different perspective. If this goes forward and you increase exemption for site-built homes but not for manufactured homes, that would place creditors of folks who live in site-built homes at a disadvantage compared to creditors of folks who live in manufactured homes, and it just doesn't seem fair to treat creditors differently. Also, if I could, just looking at the language, the existing language in the bill on line 32, the floating home exemption applies. Well, there's one for floating homes on land that is not owned, and one that floating homes that is on land that is owned. Now, I've always thought floating homes were above the land and not on the land, and so I probably shouldn't wade into that too far. But
it depends on how much it rains.
Yeah. So it seems like that if this section were to be rewritten so that all homesteads were treated the same. You could clarify that grammatical issue as well as treat manufactured homes, and it seems like an easy amendment just to say the homestead exemption is X.
Yeah, and trust me, the oversight in drafting this bill didn't catch that there was a difference, and so I wasn't really trying to treat the manufactured housing industry differently.
Mr. Chair, Sybil pointed out to me I'd missed the bill entirely, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Angela Martin, for the record, representing Our Oregon. Clearly, bankruptcy is not anyone's favorite subject. It's technical, it's depressing, and we all like to think that we're smart enough and responsible enough to avoid it altogether. But as Representative Krieger pointed out, all too often it's something that we can't predict. Medical emergency, large medical debt, that puts us in this position that we are facing bankruptcy. Testifying today, simply to get on the record, our support of House Bill 3044, echoing the comments of other proponents, and support the recommendations that they have brought forth regarding the stick-built versus manufactured homes and regarding the 2% of the homestead being available for other purpose. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I don't see any questions coming out right at the moment, and I probably would like to have a small get-together offline to discuss some of the points in this bill with those that might be interested in it in the near future. So I'll probably get a hold of you. Oh, I see some. I thought we were out of here. There's questions.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'll be really, really brief. Ms. Hebb, you had mentioned something about you might be able to get some statistics on where Oregon falls in line of the states. Is there a way that that might be able to be compared to whatever would be, you know, home values or something like that, along with those other states, too, so that I would imagine we'd want to see some sort of a comparison that would make sense in the analysis, not just the number of states, but where it would be in relation to property value? Is that possible?
Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews, that makes a good sense, and I think it's certainly something we should look at, and I'll do my best to get that information together.
Thank you, and thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony today. I don't see anybody else signed up. I don't think I missed anyone. And so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3044. Thank you, committee. Monday we have up House Bill 2613, 2614 for work session, and public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2470. I will see you on Monday. Have a good weekend. I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Good committee, Mr. Chair.